I'd explain to you why I'm late, but I'm embarrassed. In my business, that I can't find something any faster than I found this. I have a directions problem. I thought what I would do is talk for a few minutes about the allergy problem is killing me. I don't know how many of you have.
We all do. Yeah.
I drove down the Shenandoah Valley this morning with the window open. It was a mistake. Thanks. I thought I'd talk to you a little bit about sort of what I consider the perilous condition of American politics and leave most of our time for questions. And I find that's usually the most valuable.
He wrote a fascinating piece in 1992, and this has a little bit to do with our invitation, although it was only a minor part. And in it, he pointed out that some of the changes in the 70s and 80s that had taken part in elections and presidential choice. And so we wrote him and said, how about doing that kind of a thing with regard to the present? And some of the things you say may be related to that.
I've been covering presidential and congressional races now since 1960, and you see elections that are obviously influenced by what has come before. 74 congressional race, 76 presidential campaign were obviously affected by it was a reaction to Watergate to some degree. But we had a very unusual situation in 92 and 94, all the elections I've ever covered. Those were the two where, in which the electorate said we're going to use the process to make a particular point and to affect a particular change. And it was sort of you could call it a suspension of disbelief or a triumph of hope over experience or whatever. And we first became aware of this in 1992 during the New Hampshire primary campaign. If you recall, Paul Tsongas made quite a splash early in the Democratic presidential nomination, not just in New Hampshire, but there first. And he did that by presenting a very serious plan for improving the economy at a time when the voters were very concerned about the economy and about their jobs and their economic futures. And he put out an 85-page booklet, and it was called A Call to Economic Arms. And I remember being struck 9 days before the New Hampshire primary. Tsongas had a meeting over in Nashua, and it was a Sunday afternoon, cold February afternoon in New Hampshire. And I went over, there were 600 people there, and they had not been bussed in by the well-oiled Tsongas machine. There was none. They were people who came on their own. And he talked for 45 minutes. And then he took questions, and the questions went on for 2 hours and 5 minutes. And not more than a dozen people left. And the reporters like myself who had gone there, you know, probably to scoff, were bowled over because the message to us was these voters are serious people who want to know if we want to find a way to deal with the country's economic conditions through the political process. And Tsongas essentially elevated the debate. And it's interesting because Tsongas was not, his credentials were limited. He had one term in the Senate, a couple in the House. He had a minor speech defect. Paul is dead now, but he would not be offended if I say this, because he would say it himself. He had about as much charisma as a cauliflower. But he was a serious person. And he elevated the debate. He allowed Clinton, who was a policy wonk anyway, to talk about serious issues late in that campaign, rather than just about Jennifer Flowers and when and where he smoked marijuana and how he dodged the draft. In retrospect, I think we would have been better off if we would have pursued those other issues, but the debate changed, is what I'm saying, because of this seriousness of purpose. At the same time in New Hampshire, President Bush was in there playing traditional politics, bringing in celebrities. I remember they ran a big ad in the Manchester Union Leader, come and meet President Bush, see Air Force One and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Well, people were very concerned about their livelihoods in New Hampshire, and that was not quite the way to get to it. The second indicator that 92 was a different year was the Ross Perot phenomenon. If you'll recall, in March of 1992, Perot went on the Larry King Show, where he later took up sort of semi-permanent residence. But he went on the Larry King Show and said that if we would put him on the ballot in all 50 states, he would run for president. Well, the following morning, I went to my office in Washington, and I started calling secretaries of state across the country, across the time zones, at 9 o'clock. And I didn't call all 50 states. I called 15 and 16 states. And in each state, the reaction was the same, but the story was the same. When the Secretary of State arrived that morning, there were people lined up outside the office waiting to get petitions to put Perot on the ballot. Now, at the time, we did not know that Ross Perot was, to use the medical term, a certified nutcake. But we thought he was, but he was talking about serious issues, in spite of his aberrational personality and his flights of fancy. He was talking about things people were concerned about. The ultimate proof of 92 being a different year to me was the fact that George Bush was an incumbent president. He had prosecuted a very successful war in the Gulf. He was an avuncular figure who made hamburgers for his grandchildren. And he had committed no felonies in the Oval Office, so far as we ever proved. And he was a likable man to a lot of people. He got only 38% of the vote as an incumbent. Running against two candidates, Clinton and Perot, each of whom carried tremendous political baggage. I mean, Clinton would never have been elected in an ordinary year with all the things he had hanging around his neck. But the voters were saying, we're going to fix the economy, and George Bush doesn't understand what we're talking about, as he demonstrated all through the campaign. And so we're going to choose this new president. It was not a mandate for Clinton specifically, perhaps, but it was certainly a mandate for change. And the voters had spoken, and we were all impressed. The vote also rose sharply, but I mean a point and a half, 2 points. Turned out that was a lot in a presidential campaign. So you fast forward 2 years, and what had happened? Nothing. We still had gridlock in Washington. We still had inability to deal with the problems that the politicians said were the most serious. And this all sort of crystallized around the health care reform issue. In 94, one of the things I was doing as a reporter was following the campaign through three different congressional districts by starting a year ahead in advance, going to each one of those districts every month for a couple of days to see how the campaign sort of reached more people how it developed. And my thought was I would get an idea how much the Republicans are going to win if I follow these three districts. As it turned out, I underestimated how much they'd win, but you can still see this. And one of the districts I chose was in the 5th District of North Carolina, which was around Winston-Salem. And I was really struck by, in August of 94, by the difference between the Beltway perspective, meaning mine, on what was happening on health care in Washington, and that of the people in Winston-Salem. And it was a lesson that in those of us in Washington looked at this process that was then going on, which was, there were a whole bunch of committees, you'll probably remember this when I mentioned, there were a whole bunch of individual committees dealing with parts of the health care thing in the House and Senate. And they were going to try to fashion a bill by taking sort of one from column A and one from column B. And it was sort of a funny process. But we knew the people who were involved in it, and many of them in both parties, were people who had been seriously involved in this issue for many years. So they were not, we didn't find them frightening. I mean, on the Democrat, on the House, you had, Dick Gephardt and Republican elect Nancy Johnson, they'd both been involved in the issue a long time. On the Senate, you had Pat Moynihan, John Chafee. There were people, these were serious people, who knew a lot about the issue. And if anybody was going to produce a bill, they could do it. To the people in Winston-Salem, and I suspect most places, watching this, all they saw on television, on the news every night was these committee meetings being held. They would end, and these senators or congressmen would come out into the in front of the cameras and make some cryptic comment about how they hadn't made it today, they're going to have to go back tomorrow, and so forth. And people in Winston-Salem in August started saying, telling me and anybody who asked them, this is no way to do this. Let's shut it down, this process, and start again next year. That message finally, in September, sort of broke through the blood-brain barrier into Washington, and they, in fact, they did shut it down. But what we had, again, was we had a classic example of nothing being accomplished and of the government being incapable of dealing with something. Here was a problem that Clinton had identified as the single most serious problem facing the nation. Interestingly enough, he never brought it up again after that, those 2 years. But anyway, he said it was the most serious. Until we did this, we couldn't deal with anything else. People in the House were saying the same thing. I mean, the Congress was saying the same thing. This is the be-all and end-all. Yet they couldn't deal with it. This time the voters looked and they said, you know, the Democrats have been running the Congress for 40 years. This is where we are. We can't get anything done. So again, for a second time in a row, we had an electorate that said we can use the system to get something done. And they threw out the Democrats. They threw out some very good Democrats, some not so good, and turned over control to the Republicans in both houses for the first time in 40 years. And this was a message election, both of these. I found the whole thing sort of encouraging. I wasn't encouraged to see Tom DeLay and Dick Armey and the leadership, let alone Newt Gingrich. At least the voters were saying something, and they participated. So you go forward, we have two elections, and I begin to think maybe the system works. And here comes 96. Again, nothing had changed, essentially. The economy had improved, but not because of anything they had done, except to the degree that they had curtailed spending in a bipartisan way. But the system had worked no better than it had before those two elections. They were still bickering, quibbling. They had not confronted, for example, the issues that are the most important domestic issues of our time, not as exciting as civil rights was, not as exciting as the war in Vietnam, but just as important in their own way, the long-term health of the Social Security and Medicare systems. 10 days before the election of 96, the 96 Republicans, they nominated Bob Dole, who was a lovely guy that whom I like very much and that we all enjoy. He didn't care about being president. He wanted to be nominated. He wanted to cap his career. He didn't have an idea at all. And what he did do was he worked hard to help his party stave off disaster in the House races. But he didn't have any chance, never had a chance. Then you had Clinton, who hadn't raised money in such an egregiously outrageous manner. And it was beginning to come up late in the campaign that he had to go into a defensive crouch the last 10 days of the campaign, which prevented the Democrats from turning out their base vote, and they might have won the House back. Could very easily have won the House back. But Clinton didn't do that. Clinton was, all presidents are selfish. This one was even some more selfish than most. And we had an election which was, they had one issue, they had one accomplishment they all were yelling about. 10 days before the election, they passed welfare reform. Well, the welfare reform bill was not what it was, what Clinton has always said it had to be, or what anyone had said it had to be. It didn't have a lot of the elements it needed. It has been a success, as measured so far, in the fact that a lot of people have gone off welfare, but anytime you change the rules on welfare, you drive people off because there are always a lot of people cheating. In fact, though, the welfare reform successes have been largely due to the boom in the economy. Let's see how successful welfare reform looks a year from now, given the way the job market is today. and the number of jobs that are being abolished. It's not going to look so great. And we have this lackluster election. We have no record. We have nothing to talk about. We have politicians on both sides who are out of touch with one another. And you look at the result. Clinton wins by 9 points. He should have won by 15 or 20. But nobody voted. I mean, the turnout in 1996 was down to the lowest level of any presidential election since 1924. Now, stop and think about that. Think about the increase in literacy in this country, the increase in sources of information available to prospective voters, the breadth of the electorate, and the just the growth in the black electorate, just through the ones who were able to be literate. Black literacy had increased from 1924 three or four times. Still, the turnout was the lowest since 1924. That was pretty discouraging. The second term offered Clinton a chance. You always hope that in the second term a president will do something. I can remember when Kennedy was president, he only served part of one term, of course. We thought in the second term he would be the one who would finally, he would throw out J. Edgar Hoover. You wouldn't dare do it in your first term, but you might do it in the second term. We thought in the second term Richard Nixon might do something. What he did was get himself committed. What he did was commit a few felonies and have to take a pardon. But here was Clinton. Reagan had no program in the second term, deliberately. And here was Clinton at the top of his game in the sense that he was so popular. All he had to do was spend some of that popularity, and we thought, well, maybe he will now attack the Social Security and welfare, I mean, the Medicare system, and spend some of the popularity on the kind of reforms that everybody knows what needs to be done. Nobody wants to do it because it's going to hurt some. But if you're a second-term president, it doesn't matter, it shouldn't. But he didn't want to do it. Instead, he spent his capital playing slap and tickle with some giggling intern. I mean, the man's a fool. And they and betrayed his party and the system. Nothing happened. The result is we had an election in 2000 that's sort of about what we deserve. We had a brief time when it appeared we might have a serious campaign during the New Hampshire primary campaign, both Bradley on the Democratic side and John McCain raised hopes and excitement in the electorate, genuine. McCain in particular, who managed to show people that you could say exactly what you thought all the time and lightning would not strike, you would still survive. You could even prosper. Instead, the system worked what I think was sort of the worst of all ways. We nominated two candidates, neither of whom ever had to worry about where next week's paycheck was coming from, ever in their lives, which is a very serious gap, I think, in most people's life experience. Two candidates, I mean, one who didn't know Slovenia from Slovakia, the other who didn't know who he was and kept changing his persona every 6 weeks, every 3 weeks. I had been thinking about quitting writing a column regularly before this election, for this campaign. And as the campaign went on, I said about halfway through the campaign, I said to my partner, I'm quitting. At the end of the election, I can't do this anymore. He said, why? I said, I'm embarrassed. And I'm 72 years old, and I'm trying to parse the rhetoric of George W. Bush. Is that a way for a serious person to make a living? You know, I'm 72 years old, I've been doing this all my life, and I'm going to sit here and write columns about who's the real Al Gore. Is that a serious way to make a living? No, it isn't. You know, so I quit. The election was a disaster. If you notice, the country didn't want either one of them. As we tracked the polls all year, you go up, this is after the conventions. Bush would go up and he'd get 4 or 5 points ahead for about a week. And all of a sudden, the electorate would look and say, oh my God, we're going to elect him? And they'd reverse themselves. Here would come Gore up 4 or 5 points. The voters would look at him and say, oh my God. You know, 4 years of him? Well, so we've got 4 years of one of them. And I think the system is in a very debilitated condition. The chasm between the voters and the politicians is greater than it's ever been. I think the press has contributed to this. I think we do a, we are not doing as good a job as we should by any means. Newspapers, serious newspapers, spend a lot of words and a lot of effort in dealing with campaigns and try to do a decent job. That would apply, this would apply to the, you know, the, a lot of newspapers, the Times and the Post and my newspaper and the Boston Globe and a dozen others, more than that. In fact, though, most people, the people who read newspapers and read political stories in newspapers are unfortunately an elite of our electorate. They are a lot of the people in this room, I suspect. Most people are taking their diet of, of information about politics from television. And I don't like to bite the hand that feeds me because I get a lot of money out of television over the years. But I don't take it seriously. It's not serious journalism. And yet people follow the, follow these campaigns through what they see on television. I find that extremely dismaying. And particularly since it's happening at a time when the networks are spending less money and less staff doing the job than they used to. They, all the good people, the best people covering politics on the networks, people like the Ken Bodies of the world have all left because they, you know, there's no market for them. They don't want stories that have any nuance in them. They don't want stories that are, because most of the readers are not interested in politics. And I mean, they're most of the viewers, I should say. And they need to please the viewers. Newspapers will at least tolerate, you know, we carry schoolboy soccer for the parents who have kids playing soccer, so we carry politics for the political junkies. It isn't for everybody, and we know that. That is, that is certainly, I wouldn't, I don't hold newspapers blameless. We do a lot of things, we fail to do a lot of things we should do, but we do a better job than television. It doesn't matter, television is so much more important than we are in terms of affecting the way the body politic is. We have an election system now that, we have a political system now that I think most people feel really distantly estranged from, to the point that it wouldn't surprise me if we have another election and nobody votes. Not at all. Why don't I stop there, Ken? I'll take questions. If anybody wants to commit suicide, now's the time. it's the way I feel sometimes. But
who would like to begin the discussion? Charlie Smith.
Well, before you came in, Ken Thompson asked a question to this group, and there was there were a number of responses in regard to the first 100 days. And how important is the reporting of the first 100 days? Is it something worth our listening to, or is it not?
No. it's nonsense. It means nothing. It's just one of those conventions. I mean, the first 100 days, when originally this was the first 100 days of Roosevelt. You were dealing with a new president coming in with a crisis with a program of items to be checked off. This president hasn't got any program. He's got, you know, he's got some old ideas. They're trotting out the, you know, same ideas his party has put forward, which is nothing wrong with it necessarily, but just it's what they've got. And there's no reason, there's no rush. I mean, they're not gonna stop the economy. The only thing is, I've been amazed at the Washington Post has a lot of good political reporters, but I've been laughing at the tortured lengths they're going to analyze this administration, because there's not much happening, you know. I mean, Rumsfeld now wants to, you know, review our defense posture. Well, of course he does. Everything he's saying, he was saying the last time he was defense secretary, and every other defense secretary says this. Now they're talking about energy. You're not going to beat the energy. You're not going to beat energy with just by conservation. You got to have new supplies. We hear that back. It's that same argument. The quotes are the same as they were in the Carter days. I mean, nothing is any different. It is So judging the 100 days is... The one thing I will say that I think that George W. Bush has... the 100 days, or any reasonable period, he has managed to present a softer edge, a more amiable face put on the politics, not in terms of his conduct, but in terms of his manner. I mean, if you pick John Ashcroft to be Attorney General, you're saying to a lot of people, I'm getting right in your face. You know, it's really a hostile act to a lot of people, putting Ashcroft there. But he did it. But he does most of the things. He has the manner to make it easier. On the other hand, the thing he has not done is persuade a large minority of Americans that he's competent, that he's smart enough for the job. I don't think you have to be all that smart, but, you know, reasonably. And he has not yet convinced a great many people. And I find the same thing. I was out in Iowa 2 weeks ago, and I was having dinner with 60 people a generation younger, not in politics. And I asked them what they thought about Bush. And as it happened, there were two Bush voters there, and three who had voted for Gore, and one who had committed the stupid act of voting for Ralph Nader. But what struck me was they all had the same impression. When Bush was on making a speech, they were sort of hanging on every word and sort of hoping he wouldn't screw up, that he wouldn't say. And I find that reporters, whether they like him or not, agree with him or not, every time I listen to him, I'm saying, I hope he's going to get through this, because it makes you feel sort of uneasy. And that is he hasn't gotten by that in the 100 days. That's a problem for him. And that's why I think he's a very vulnerable, potentially very vulnerable for a second term.
And next question, next comment, Keith Eubank.
Do you think McCain and Bradley were unable to do better?
Why do you think McCain, I'll repeat for the people now, why do you think McCain and Bradley were unable to do better?
Well, there were two separate things. Bradley made a strategic mistake, but not the tactical, by going into the Iowa caucuses. I mean, he made a couple of mistakes in his campaign that allowed Gore an opportunity. If he had not gone into Iowa, where he had no real chance because of those caucuses were a real party function. If he had not lost in Iowa, he probably would have won New Hampshire, because he lost New Hampshire by a couple of points. If he had won New Hampshire, he'd have beaten Gore. I mean, if Gore was, there were enough doubts about Gore's ability as a candidate, so if he ever lost anything, he would, in the political sense, bleed to death on the floor. But Bradley had some bad advice, and he was too sure that he could do it his way, as he sometimes is. His strength was that Bradley paid the voters the respect of talking about serious matters in a serious way. He had only five issues he was talking about, essentially. And one of them was race, which is counterintuitive for Democratic politicians these days. They try to stay away from the issue. They think it's too touchy. And then Bill addressed it directly. I thought it was much in his favor. But in the long run, the party, the establishment was too wedded to Gore. They might have left him if he had lost, but as long as he was winning, there was no chance. And by that I mean labor and all the interest groups. They all endorsed him. They all committed themselves to Gore early, and they're important in primary. The McCain phenomenon was, McCain was beaten by a failure, I think I consider a failure of the system. As people who got to know McCain, as they did in New Hampshire because of the long primary season, people who got to know him recognized he was a very different kind of candidate. That even if they didn't agree with him on particular issues, that didn't matter so much as the fact that they liked what they saw in him. And I had this In covering that primary, I had a town called Milford, New Hampshire. It's a town of 10,000 people, and that's in the southwest part of the state. And I started going there in early 99 once a month for 2 or 3 days and talked to the local activists in both parties and to other people in general, and then go back and see the same people, go and, you know, go to the Rotary Club meeting, get a few of those people, sit down, talk with me afterwards about what they were hearing and so on. And it was interesting because in May and June of 99, when John McCain was like 3 points in the polls, I went over to, I was over in Milford, I'm talking to these local Republican leaders, the selectmen and a town committeeman, the town chairman, Republican chairman, and all the kind of people you would expect to be with Bush. You had the senators and the congressmen and all the establishment, political establishment. And they were all saying, you know, I sort of like this guy McCain. And they noticed that on Kosovo, McCain was not afraid to speak up. And he just kept doing this. And he did 114 town meetings. And over this period of a year, well, not a year, but 8 months, 9 months, people got, they got a lot of information about him. They saw him a lot. And he was consistent. When he made a mistake, he said something dumb. Before we'd get it in the paper, he'd say, I made a dumb mistake there a couple of hours ago. I should have said so, I shouldn't have said that. And it would still be in the paper, but he would catch up with himself. And he was not afraid of any of the forms. I mean, there was a funny thing that happened during that period. That, you know, John McCain is not popular with his colleagues and Republican colleagues in the Senate because he's too much of a maverick. He's independent. And I was back in Washington one night having dinner at the Monocle restaurant up in Capitol Hill with my wife and there was a Republican senator there, and he was going out after dinner, and he stopped to say hello. And I said, yeah, your colleague from Arizona is making quite a splash up in New Hampshire. And the senator said to me, you know, the leader is very unhappy with John, meaning that Trent Lott was very unhappy with John McCain. And I said, you know, I said, when John McCain was in that prison camp in Hanoi, Trent Lott was the head cheerleader at Ole Miss. Do you think he cares? That's exactly true. And that was his attitude. So he wins by 19 points in New Hampshire, where they knew him well. There was never another occasion when he could get known well enough to enough people because of the nature of the campaign and the nature of the press coverage. And it was all driven by, he made a couple of mistakes, McCain did. I mean, he lost his temper and he lambasted, you know, Pat Robertson and some other fundamentalists. That was probably not politic, but the fact is the system didn't allow him to become known, to get close to people. And the press is part of this. The voters are a big part of this. You can get away with the Bush people did a very good job of cutting him up and bringing him down to size because the American people are lazy and they don't believe anything if they hear it enough. I'll give you an example. You know, he wins by 19 points in New Hampshire. The Bush campaign, they go down to Austin and they retire to Austin for a weekend and they have a big meeting, strategy meeting. Monday morning, George W. steps out of his telephone booth and announces that he is a reformer with results. Well, he had never reformed anything other than his drinking habits, as far as we know. Anything. The piece of evidence he cites was a bill that he had vetoed, actually, at one point. He had no record of reform. But he gets up, he's a reformer with results. Every surrogate in the Bush campaign, everybody speaking for Bush all over the country, talked about the reformer with results, reformer with results, reformer with results. It was everywhere. It was in every message. Every time he spoke, and you may remember seeing this, he would stand up, he had a press conference every day, he's standing in front of the microphone, behind him is a big blue curtain. On the curtain in silver letters, reformer with results. 10 days of this, polling Republican primary voters, which candidate is the true reformer, John McCain or George Bush? He broke even with McCain. I mean, that's ridiculous. George Bush did some things. Bush is like his father. These Ivy Leaguers don't think nasty politics counts because it's not their people they're doing it to. But he also did these things. He had down in South Carolina. He trotted out this old guy, I can say that he's my age, who was the head of some phony veterans organization, a paper organization, who said that John McCain had abandoned the veterans once he got in politics. To accuse John McCain of all people of abandoning veterans is ridiculous. But the charge was made, it's got a lot of attention on television, the rebuttal never caught up with it. It had an effect. We went to the New York primary. The Bush people had a woman who announced that she was a breast cancer victim, and she announced that McCain had been derelict in supporting funding for research and treatment of breast cancer. For one thing, one of McCain's sisters has suffered from breast cancer, so it's hard to think that he was that immune to concern about the issue. Second, it wasn't true. And the woman 3 days later recanted, said she was sorry she said it wasn't true. Again, it never caught up. I mean, he got killed by this conventional politics and all the money in the world to spend it rallying around. And a failure of the press. I mean, we went through all this stuff in the Sun. We did a long, detailed story about that. Who was reading it? Nobody. You know, people going to read didn't need it. People who need it are the ones who were taking their news from television. Kill them. That's what did it, I think.
Yeah. Next question, comment. Cliff Byes, did you have
it? This fellow down here.
Okay.
What issues surround the Bush administration, those dealing with like green affairs, energy conservation, the past thing, so?
Can you stand up and read it? I can't hear, we can't hear.
How do you think the issues surrounding the Bush administration, like those dealing with green affairs, energy conservation, defense spending, will affect his reelection?
How do you think the handling of conservation and foreign affairs in the Bush administration will affect his reelection?
I think barring on the foreign policy area, national security policy area, barring a direct threat to this country, nobody cares. I mean, you don't change two votes on those issues. A few contractors. Perhaps. But the one place that the Bush White House, pardon me, or the administration so far, has been unsure of itself, has been on this whole matrix of issues, energy, conservation, environment, these related issues. And the reason for that is they made an original mistake of treating them in a cavalier fashion, and they began to realize that the environment is not a partisan concern, and there are as many Republican environmentalists as there are Democratic, actually. And that is an issue which has potential for being a problem for Bush. I think I think it's a mistake to look at these candidates, incumbent or challengers, and take lists of issues and check them off, you know, which side they're on, and try to figure out who's going to win that way. I think the decision is made more on the judgment people make about the person, partly related to those issues. It may be, for example, if you're pro-choice, that you could not support someone who's against abortion rights. There may be some litmus test issues. But aside from those issues, two or three issues that are very, that used to be in civil rights was a clear litmus test issue for people. Aside from issues like that, most people make their judgments on impressions that are not founded on any particular lists. Yeah, that's fine. Thanks,
Robert Hollow.
It seems to me that returning to the Congress now, it seems to me that the rise of the current rock hard attitudes, partisan attitudes in Congress, kind of coincided with the change, liberalization of the selection process. More primaries, the rise of the consultant and the pollster, all that stuff. Do you think that things could be improved by returning to the smoke filled room?
Going to the what?
Smoke filled room.
Would we be better off going to the smoke filled rooms?
I would. As a reporter of my vintage, I'd love it because I'd know all the guys in the room. And it's never going to happen. I mean, this is. We always take every idea in this country and carry it out to a ridiculous extreme, and that's what we've done in the nominating process. I mean, the Democrats even make it worse, because they have to have the proper ethnic and gender mix and everything else in their delegations. We carry every idea, but there's no way to turn back. It's not going to happen. You know? And every once in a while, there's I get invited to go on some panel where they're talking about reforms of the system, and I always turn them down. And why? Because I said, I was a sophomore in college a long time ago. That's about what this is worth talking about. It's not going to happen.
The next question, yes.
I think one of the most substantive things that happens in the first 100 days is the staffing of a new administration. And I wish you'd comment on what you think is the quality of this cabinet and Bush's relationship to it.
The question is about quality of Bush's cabinet and the implications of that.
I think some of the people on the cabinet, a lot of people in the cabinet, I think are quite good. There are some I think are frightening. I mean, the idea of that particular Ashcroft for Attorney General, I find mind-boggling. I mean, the choice is an important issue to me. I think it's an important issue, but aside from that, the fact is Ashcroft would not have been confirmed if he had not been a senator. And Bush paid a terrible price for this because he required several Republicans who didn't want to vote for Ashcroft but did but had to walk the plank for him. And he's not going to get him now, and he needs him on other things. That's certainly true of those two women senators from Maine and from Jeffords and a few others. Having said that, I think a lot of the other appointments in the cabinet are good ones. And the staff is about what you would expect. Like Mitch Daniels, the guy who's the new budget director, is a very able guy, and I think he's a worthwhile. He's a conservative Republican, but he's not an ideological nut. I mean, they shouldn't expect liberals. The Democrats complain about the choices. You know, they lost the election. You know, they ought to go see Ralph Nader. He's the guy. That's where they got a beef. The Karl Rove, who's the main political guy in the White House, is somebody I've known for 20 some years. He was not just a Bush guy. He was done politics in Texas for many years. And he's a very streetwise guy and very savvy. I think the most striking thing about this thing is the dependence on Dick Cheney. I was in Florida having lunch with some Florida Republicans when Cheney had his little episode with his heart. And they were these were tour political types. They were in a panic, and I was laughing at them. I said, look at you. I said, the vice president gets a heart blip, and you're all in a sweat. What does it tell you about the president? And that's a good question. What does it tell you about the president? The reliance on Cheney is, Cheney is someone that everybody who's been around Washington a long time knows and thinks very well of. I don't agree personally with a lot of his positions, of course, because he's much more conservative than we fellow travelers. But I don't think those things are important to him. I think making the thing work is important to him. I think he's very hard line on some of those issues because he's afraid of his wife. But they're not high on his agenda. I think having him there is a very comforting thing. Rumsfeld, as defense secretary, I find a little more. We've all known him a long time too. I find it a little more unnerving. He's a very frightening guy in getting his way, and I just think that he may have his mind set in a different era. I don't think. I don't think the staff is bad. I don't think the appointments are bad.
Next question. Yes.
Would you discuss campaign finance reform as passed by the Senate?
Yeah. The campaign finance reform, would you please discuss?
Everybody knows the campaign finance thing is not enough. The real danger here is that people if they get a bill that Bush signs, Bush will sign a bill if it's reasonable. If they get a bill that Bush signs, they're all going to be, you know, they're all going to be dislocating their shoulders, patting themselves on the back for this, for finally stopping the stealing, you know, and passing this piece of legislation. The danger is that will put it on the back burner for another generation. I think that's likely, that nobody will bother. They'll keep saying, we just passed the campaign finance reform. And there are a lot of holes in this thing, and a lot of ways around it. People will find ways around it. It just takes a little while. I mean, these things are, it's amazing how these things develop. And if you indulge me, I'll just tell you a story about soft money. Soft money was approved in 1979. It was almost no attention given to it. They didn't call it soft money then. They passed a bill to let state parties raise money separately so they'd have money for get out the vote and so forth, registration campaigns. And it was not to be used for candidates. And I remember at the time, I was working for the Washington Star then. And I remember writing a piece about it. Nobody thought much about it. And the next year in the 80 campaign, I was down in Texas. And I went into the Reagan headquarters down there. And the Reagan campaign was run by a guy named Ernie Angelo, who was a national committeeman from Texas. And he was the mayor of some town out of West Texas, Odessa, or Midland. And he, they had this other office right next door. And they had some name for it. And there's a guy in there, and I asked him, I said, what is this? He said, this was the state party, and this was the running the state parties. This was the office where the state party got its money and spent its money. And they, of course, didn't have the limits on contributions. And, of course, he says, we have to keep that separate. Well, it was separate, except the guy who was in there worked for him. And there were only about two or three states where they had discovered that this loophole was there that year. The Democrats typically were a little slow on the uptake. And in 84, they finally got, I think the Republicans had soft money or this money in Texas and Ohio, maybe one other state. In 84, they had it in seven states. And finally, the Democrats had it in two or three. I mean, the whole thing just sort of sat there until one guy discovered what a loophole it was. It was Bob Farmer, who was the finance director for Dukakis on the 88 campaign. And he found what the loophole was and raised, you know, $100 million or whatever, or $70 million. These things, there'll be something, there's something in this bill. You know, if we knew what it was, presumably they would close it. Presumably they wouldn't.
Victor, in the back.
In 1996, Ross Perot pulled in a lot of votes for an independent third-party candidate. I was wondering, what helped him pull in more than any other independent candidate has so far? And do you ever foresee an independent third-party candidate winning in a presidential election?
Ross Perot pulled in a lot of votes. What effect did it have on the Clintons' vote? Is that what you...
He pulled in a lot of votes, and what allowed him to bring in all these extra votes as opposed to what the other independent candidate
would do.
And do you ever foresee independent candidate winning a presidential election?
I think I'll take this sort of in reverse. I don't think a third party candidate is likely to do that because there's sort of an inertia for the two party system that the most impressive third party vote was the was Perot in 92 when he got 19%, and I think he cost Bush that election. You know, Bush probably should have been indicted for Mopri anyway that year, but it is the third party. I mean, there are always a lot of people who are going to be beguiled, enough people to make a fact are going to be beguiled by a third party. If there is a candidate who can get their attention. In the case of Perot, when Perot started to run in 1992, he said he's going to spend $50 million of his own money. We treated him in the press, we treated him like a serious player from the get-go. And the reason we did was he knew he could buy his way into being serious, and he did. Up to June of 92, he was running second in the polls nationally. Clinton was running third. In 96, when he ran again, and we had discovered his temperamental predilections, he still spent enough money in enough places. There are just the people you're going to tap. If you look at Nader didn't have the money, but Nader had enough reputation as a national figure from other things to get attention. And he didn't get anywhere near as many votes, but he had enough votes to he caused go of the election, no question. And they, how would you like to be Ralph Nader these days, trying to go to a Democrat in the House and get something done?
One or two more questions. Yes, Ken Wallenberg.
Comments in today's Wall Street Journal by Daschle about judicial appointments and the fact that he, I think, said we're going to block every judicial appointment.
The comments by Senator Daschle about judicial appointments, does that mean the Democrats are going to block every judicial appointment?
You know, both sides do exactly the same thing on this. I mean, they're all staring each other down. And the Republicans have held up a lot of judicial appointments on Clinton. And now the same thing is going to happen. And what they're going to finally do is trade them off a few, you know. As they go, all the indignation about this, I find hard to take seriously because both parties do it. And the Daschle is a very good leader, a very tough partisan. Of course, he's going to say this. They're going to make deals like they do all the time. You know, you even had this in the end of the last administration after the election. Senator Hatch, the chairman of the Judiciary, gave the White House, just out of the goodness of his heart, five judgeships they could have. They just picked out five judges. He got them confirmed for him the last week. Because I know one of the ones who didn't get picked of the five. And it was, you know, isn't any different.
Another question?
Oh, I was going to ask, is Strom Thurmond going to be here for Christmas?
Is Strom Thurmond going to be here for Christmas?
I don't. You know, I live in West Virginia on the Shenandoah River, but I have an apartment in Alexandria, which my wife uses. She works full time, three nights a week, and I'm usually in there two nights a week. And one of the other inhabitants of this apartment is Strom Thurmond, and he gets on the elevator. He's in a wheelchair now. He was walking with help, and I run into him, and he sees me, and he knows he ought to recognize me. He knows that I come from, he's somewhere, I'm somebody he has encountered over the years. But for the life of me, can't figure out how. And you can see way back in his eyes somewhere, there's a little flicker of something. It is so. The people of South Carolina ought to be ashamed of themselves. I mean, on the other hand, senators aren't that important, so it doesn't matter. You know. I mean, he's only important now because he gives the Republicans the 50th vote. What one senator can do or not. You know, if you're going to do something important, be a mayor or a governor, if you're going to be a senator, all senators do is hold hearings, you know.
Any questions about people of lesser age?
I wanted to ask a question about Colin Powell. He commented on the Bush administration, he commented on Cheney, he commented on Rumsfeld. He has not commented on Colin Powell or on the interaction among the three.
Comments on Colin Powell?
I don't know about interaction because I am not. I have not done enough reporting on the stories that there would be. We all know that Powell is more cautious than some people might like as a military leader. We also know that Rumsfeld will cut your throat to get his way and has done that against some very formidable bureaucratic players. So I don't know how well he's. So I don't know how well Powell is doing. He has not been. He's had a couple of occasions when he's been sort of left out on a limb by his boss, by the president. But that's happened to a lot of people in this administration. And I think he. This is the job he wanted. He obviously, what everybody's looking for is him getting on the ticket for vice president. I think the Republicans think they could transform the electorate that way. I'm not sure that's true, but the I'm not sure, and I'm not sure that he is really ever going to want to do it.
Well, we've. Do you want one final question?
I just wanted to ask about comment about Christy Whitman and her relationship with him. Who's going to win that battle?
Who's going to win the environmental battle between Christy Whitman and President Bush?
Oh, she hasn't got any cards. I mean, you know, she's holding a very small pair, as they say. I don't know, frankly, I don't know why she didn't quit. Nobody ever seems to quit. She does come from a political family. I mean, she's been in politics a long time, and it's the party thing to do is to stick with it. I thought that was embarrassing what happened to her twice in a row. And they, you know, they keep now the White House. You know, the White House people will tell you, you know, that give you a little inside scoop that she's really in great, really highly regarded, and she's getting a lot done that you don't see. Yeah. That's what you hear. I think she's, you know, that party has, the Republican Party has turned away from the element of the party that Christy Whitman represents in a very significant way in the last few elections. I mean, we now have we used to talk about the Solid South. Now you have Republicans with a fairly solid South being cracked a little. What's really solid now is the Northeast for the Democrats, and that's mostly because of suburbs, and it's for because of people like people like Christy Whitman, and it's on the cultural issues because the people in the suburbs, the Whitman voters. Are not comfortable with Tom DeLay and Dick Armey, and they weren't with Gingrich. And it's, we've got a real realignment of the dynamics, quite different. And I think she has no future in that party. She has the future in that party that Nelson Rockefeller had, you know, as vice president under Ford.
We've had a good exposure to someone telling it like it is, and, we don't always have that, even with very distinguished people. So whether you agree or disagree, it seems to me that point is worth taking with you as you leave the auditorium. The other point I wish you'd take with you is that Jack German was starting. I was working for writing about politics. I was working for a foundation, and I learned quite a little bit about how to spend money. It was a very, very difficult undertaking. More complicated than I ever dreamed it was. Now we're trying to learn about how to get money, and we've got a balance that's very substantial and a beautiful new building. And the prospects of getting a German to come to the Miller Center and anybody like him depends a lot on the sum total of the development of a place like the Miller Center. I'd written to him, I suppose, 5 years ago or other years ago, and same with Johnny Apple and Paul and Jim Lehrer and the other people in this series. We didn't always get a return response the same day, sometimes the same year. But the chances of getting the response are infinitely greater to the extent that the Miller Center as a whole can develop, as it seems to be developing, as one of the two or three, four or five great centers in the world studying public affairs, and perhaps the premier one studying the presidency. And that's why having all of you here for a change, not every day that you come. Why I want once more to reiterate that our hopes for the future depend a lot on what you do in the coming few months in trying to help us meet the balance that we face on the cost of the Miller Center addition. So we thank you all very much for coming, most of all the way from West Virginia under a difficult and complicated road instructions given by the executive director of the Miller Center, Mr. Morris.
It wasn't his that threw me off.
Anyway, whatever the cause, this has been a high point for us in listening to what somebody can say after 42 years of working the leather action, as the National Press Club said, in order to get at some semblance of the truth. And so we thank you very much. Most of all, thank him. Thank you.